Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We are a nation that likes our seafood, sushi, salmon, crab cakes, cod. In the U.S., we eat an average of 16.5 pounds of seafood per person each year, and that's half again as much as we ate back in 1960. And part of the reason we lack our fish is the growing evidence that fish is good for us. A recent study from the Institute of Medicine concluded that fish is good for the heart and recommends that we keep seafood in our diets. So, well, that's the good news. Now for the bad news. By mid-century, there may not be enough seafood to go around. A new study out in last week's issue of the journal Science reaches a really shocking conclusion that by the year 2048, there may be little sustainable fish or seafood left in the oceans. Overfishing is partly to blame, the researchers say, but the bigger problem is that our management, or you might call it our mismanagement of the oceans, has left them overfished, polluted, and without protection for fish habitats. That has led to a loss of biodiversity in the ocean that goes hand in hand with steeply declining fish numbers. But the study holds out some hope for the seafood lover in you. Remember, there is time to change the projected outcome if we change the way we manage our oceans. And a group of government scientists from the National Marine Fisheries Service, that's part of NOAA, says the report is flawed and the condition of marine fish stocks is far less bleak than the study suggests. So that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this hour. If you'd like to join our discussion, please do. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com for links to our topics and our guests. Let me introduce my guests. Boris Worm is a professor of marine conservation biology at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He joins me today by phone from his office there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Worm.
Hello, Ira. Good to be here.
Thank you. Steve Morosky is the chief scientist at the National Marine Fisheries Service at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's NOAA in Silver Spring, Maryland, and he joins us today by phone from his office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Morosky.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Patrick Sullivan is associate professor in the Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He joins us today from the campus there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Well, Lee Crockett is the executive director of the Marine Fish Conservation Network in Washington, and he is in our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program, Mr. Crockett.
Thank you, Ira.
Let me begin by asking you, Boris Worm, you said that your conclusion that we may have no fish by 2048 is a projection and not a prediction. What's the difference here? Are we splitting hairs or is there a real difference?
No, there's a big difference. A prediction is not done by scientists. It's done by people who have crystal balls and who pretend to know the future. I don't know the future. What I know is that we see from various data sources, including World Fisheries data, we see a global trend of declining biodiversity. This doesn't mean that biodiversity or the number of species is declining in every one region all the same. There's a lot of regional variation and scatter there. But on average, globally speaking, we see a decline in ocean species that's very concerning because it seems to be accelerating. And we're concerned about the consequences that has for human well-being and for the ability of the ocean to recover what's lost.
Give me some numbers on what kinds of declines we're talking about. What kinds of fish, what percentage we're...
Okay. Well, we had various elements to the research. The one that's most widely cited is our analysis of a version of the FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, catch data, which imply that right now 29% of fish stocks that are globally contributing to our seafood are collapsed. Now, collapsed in our definition means that the catches of these species, so what we're able to extract out of the ocean regarding these species, has declined by 90% or more since the historical maximum.
Mm-hmm. When you say that that biodiversity is declining, what is the connection between the fish and the biodiversity, and what we mean by biodiversity in the oceans?
By biodiversity, we mean the total sum of species in the ocean. So this ranges from the tiny microscopic plankton that feed the larger plankton that feed the fish larvae that grow into large fish that feed us, the whole food chain in the ocean, if you will. And what the seafood part of it is, it's just a a tiny fraction, actually, of that large chain, but it's the fraction that we see, that we perceive, because that's what's landing on our plates and what's feeding the planet. Now, if we look back much larger over many different species, we have a timeline of 1,000 years in one part of our study for species ranging from plankton all the way to whales. If you look at species loss there over that historic time period, we see that actually 38% of species are collapsed, and 7% of the species we had data for were extinct in the regions, meaning they were not found at all anymore. And that had some grave consequences for fisheries, but also for habitats and for water quality.
Were you surprised by this, the rate of decline of the diversity, biodiversity here?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we were all surprised. We were surprised by the rate of decline and concerned, obviously, but also surprised by how much the results from very different data sets were matching up. We looked at four different types of data: experiments, historical data, fisheries data, and data from marine reserves and fishery closures. And in the end, they all told us how important biodiversity really is in supporting fisheries, in supporting water quality and other ecosystem services that are so vital to humanity.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Steve Morosky, do you agree with Dr. Wurm's assessment?
Well, we certainly take some of the messages that are in this report about biodiversity being different in different parts of the world, and certainly the areas with inherently low biodiversity, like the polar ecosystems, are particularly fragile, and we need to be cognizant of that. But the overall message that all global taxa supporting fisheries will be collapsed by 2048, we think, number one, the projection is incorrect. It's based on what we would consider to be imperfect data. And secondly, it doesn't comport with the trends that we see, particularly in the United States, where we see a flattening out, in fact, an uptick in the proportion of species that are fished at the right levels and stocks are sustainable rates of harvest. So we don't see this sort of pessimistic view that stocks are necessarily all headed to collapse by that period of time. We just don't buy the assessment.
Are you saying that you're reading the same data but not agreeing with the analysis, or you don't agree with the data itself?
Well, there's two factors. Number one, we don't agree that fishery catch is necessarily reflective of the underlying fishery population. I'll cite an example. Georgia's bank haddock, which is a very important species on the east coast of the United States, had a historical maximum catch of 150,000 tons in 1965. The reason that catch was so high was there was large domestic fishing and overfishing by foreign fleets that were on our coast. Now, those foreign fleets are gone. The catch in 2003 was 12,000 tons, which is 8%. But the stock size is high in building now, and the stock is under regulation. So by just looking at the catches, you get a misleading view, particularly in areas of the world where we have had effective fisheries management and stocks are rebuilding. So we don't, number one, the metric, because you're taking this worldwide view, it's sort of a lowest common denominator metric. And we have much better data in the developed world on the actual underlying stock sizes. And so by interpreting just catches, you may get a skewed view, particularly in areas of the world where we're rebuilding stocks. So we don't buy that. And then in terms of the patterns we see, in the United States, currently about 26% of the stocks that we regulate are in an overfished condition. Now, an overfished condition is only 50% of its biomass that is our long-term goal. And in fact, the fraction of stocks in an overfished condition is declining, not increasing. And so the worldwide trend that is supported by this statement that all global taxa currently fished would be collapsed is not correct in terms of the patterns that we see in the United States and elsewhere in the developed world.
Patrick Sullivan, where do you weigh in on this?
Well, it's pretty dramatic seeing the change that's going on there. And I think, like Steve said, there's a lot of good messages that can be taken out of it. I found the paper pretty interesting in terms of the biodiversity part of it. But I was quite taken aback by the projection of collapsed fish stocks by 2040. It's just hard to believe. You look around what's happening with the United States, things seem to be well. And so you start thinking, you know, is the diversity higher in certain areas, like in China and so forth? You know, China leads the world in terms of fish production. from fishing, and conceivably it has higher taxa there. So conceivably something like China could skew the results, but you really wonder, you know, what role the U.S. can play in this, and how it would affect sort of the world picture.
So you're buying Dr. Worm's analysis that it's going to collapse. So you're just shocked by it.
Actually, I don't buy it.
You don't buy it. Okay.
Just I don't buy it, but it was difficult for me to actually find the source materials that were used to do the analysis. Mm-hmm. So I don't have anything to rebut from it. I mean, one of the pictures I'm looking at is seeing the cumulative effect overall, which shows like 50% to 80% of the stocks are currently collapsed. And I really have a hard time believing that that's so. So I must be misinterpreting the data somehow. I just don't see that that's possible.
Can Lee I just Crockett? Cut in and
yeah, Lee? Let me just Dr. Worm, I'll get back to you. Sure. Just want to get the whole table run the table here. First.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify something, but I can do that later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Ira. Well, when we see this, you know, I represent a group of fishermen and conservationists, and we look at this as another call to action that we need to do a better job of managing our ocean fish. And I just want to take a couple of clarifying points to what Steve Murawski was saying. First of all, when he was, I don't dispute his number 26 and change of overfished stocks, but what we're really talking about is we manage to a level called maximum sustainable yield, and that means 40% of historic sizes. And then when he says 50%, that means we're looking at below 20% of historic sizes. So overfished stocks are severely depleted. Secondly, we've taken a look at the National Marine Fisheries Service data, and we don't see this uptick. We looked at data from 2001 to 2004, and when you look at stocks that they know are healthy, they've been assessed and they are not overfished, that means depleted or subject to too high overfishing, there's been no change. There's 91, which is about 13% of the managed fish stocks in the United States. So we see a lot of reason for concern in the United States, and you know, we think that you know, more needs to be done to address the issues that Dr. Worm and his colleagues have identified.
Dr. Worm, your rebuttal.
So, hi, Steve. Hi, Patrick. Helly. I agree with most of your points, really. And I agree that the United States has taken the right measures. About 10 years ago, there was a new legislation introduced that was mandated to stop overfishing very strongly and to rebuild fish stocks that have been depleted or lost. And obviously, that's a wonderful thing to do. It's a hard thing to do in practice. The result 10 years later is that we have 74 stocks that are requiring recovery. There's rebuilding plans for 67 of them. Three of those have been recovered to a level that is supposed to be maximum sustainable yield, and half of these are still being overfished, meaning it has not been possible to curb fishing pressure enough to even give them a chance to recover. So I'm absolutely applauding the legislation and the idea of rebuilding fish stocks, because that's exactly what we're saying in this paper. Now, Steve, the example you give for Georges Bank Haddock is one I give all the time, because it's one of the poster children, if you wish, of successful management. It resulted from the emergency measure of closing about half of Georges Bank in, I think it was 1994, and in order to stop the ongoing collapse of groundfish stocks. And it was a very successful measure. And an analysis that Steve has done is actually part of our paper, where we look at the effects of fishery closures and marine reserves in rebuilding biodiversity, in rebuilding fishery, rebuilding the stability of the system. And that analysis, of course, shows, according to what Steve was saying, that if you do the right thing, you get recovery and you get economic benefits relatively quickly, more quickly than people had thought, from that. So that's a very, very hopeful message, and Georges Bank Haddock is a good example for that. But it is an exception that proves a rule of global overfishing that's going on despite better evidence in many different countries, including the U.S., although the U.S. is leading the track record here ahead of many other countries. I agree with that point.
Talking about fish populations this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Are we talking about overfishing, or as the problem of fish populations? Or are we talking about the loss of the biodiversity, the food chain, where the fish are not getting enough to eat, and right. and what would and the pollution and whatever the causes of that is?
Well, what I would say to that is that it's a really a cumulative effect of overfishing and habitat destruction, pollution, and climate change. Various panels that were working under the United States government or other panels that have come out with reports recently concluded those are the four major problems we have to tackle. One problem with rebuilding plans is that they're often focusing on one thing, which is overfishing, which is often the main cause, no doubt about that. But there's other things going on as well, and some of them are accelerating dramatically, like climate change, for example, that has been shown to be inhibiting, for example, the recovery of North Sea cod from overfishing by changes in the plankton ecosystem. So there's a lot of things going on that require our attention.
Steve, would you agree?
Well, I certainly think that you know, we can't look at fish in a vacuum and just look at harvesting. There are lots of pressures in the world, and they include coastal development. They include the impacts of climate variability and on the recruitment of fish populations. They're just one bellwether of how ecosystems are standing. We also see the rapid development of population at the coast. Over half the U.S. population currently lives within 25 miles of the coast, and that proportion is increasing. And so it puts pressure on habitats. And so certainly agree that the ecosystem approaches to the management not only of fisheries but the larger suite of marine organisms is important, and it's actually one of NOAA's goals to try to advance an ecosystem approach and make our different management efforts harmonize. And I think there is, of course, a very important message in this paper, and that is we need to be more effective, particularly in areas of the developing world with the fishery management governance institutions. For example, we have a number of ongoing problems with unregulated, unreported, and illegal fishing on the high seas, the so-called IUU. The world management institutions need to get a better handle on that.
All right, Steve, I'm going to have to stop you there because we have to take a break, but we'll come back and pick that point up after we take this break. So don't go away. We're going to talk more, get your questions in, and we'll be going to the phones talking about fish population shortages and how much seafood there's going to be left in 50 years. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the decline of ocean biodiversity and the future of fish with my guests, Patrick Sullivan of Cornell University, Lee Crockett of the Marine Fish Conservation Network, Boris Worm of the University of Dalhousie University in Halifax, and Steve Morosky of National Marine Fisheries Service in Silver Spring. Our number 1-800-989-8255. And Steve was talking when I'm rudely interrupted him, I think, about illegal fishing being a problem. Is that correct, Steve?
Right. The point I was trying to make is that, you know, I think we've all agreed that the United States is doing better worldwide than a number of other places. Certainly you would categorize other developed nations like New Zealand and Australia as being examples of places where we've got good laws on the books and are making some progress. And we need to take that expertise and make sure that we can be more effective internationally to assist other countries in developing their governance institutions and to assist in the control measures. And the United States and other countries can do a better job way by participating in the so-called regional fishery management organizations, or RFMOs. And the United States and other countries are members of these RFMOs. They can help to address these things like illegal fishing on the high seas and also the management of animals that are very wide-ranging, for example, bluefin tuna in the Atlantic range to both sides of the Atlantic, and there is an RFMO that needs to be more effective. So we need to look at these institutions and try to use our expertise and use our position in those organizations to be more effective.
Let's go to Chuck in Anchorage. Hi, Chuck. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Still morning here, but I have a couple quick things. As a commercial fisherman, salmon fisherman, Alaska wild salmon, we're faced with a conundrum here. At the same time, food stocks are seafood stocks are projected to go on kind of a downhill slide. We're facing some of the worst prices we've gotten for years, and largely it's because of farmed fish, aquaculture.
Yeah, so what to do about that?
Right.
Yeah.
Could I respond to that?
An interesting aside on that is that a lot of the food stock for aquaculture operations are actually, it comes from the biomass that basically comes from the larger ocean. So it's actually, in some sense, perhaps contributing to the problem.
Uh-huh. Let me see if I can get some comment. Who wants to jump in?
I can jump in on that. I think one of the things that is worthwhile thinking about is what we do with marine fisheries is really trying to utilize a resource in balance with the ecosystem. If we contrast that with something like rice, basically we get rid of the ecosystem and put our own ecosystem in. And we're not doing that in marine systems. We're trying to work in balance. And I think that shows some favor for wild-reared salmon as opposed to aquaculture. But there's a lot of ways that this can be done, and I think working with the ecosystem is the right way to do it.
Big Crockett, do you have anything?
Yeah, I wanted to point out that Chuck hit on a very important point, that aquaculture generally uses these what are called forage species that are like sardines, anchovies, things like that, that are very important components of the marine ecosystem. They serve as food for a variety of fish, marine mammals, birds, and they're being increasingly used to feed this aquaculture industry, and it's not a very efficient process. It's something on the order of 2 pounds of these forage fish for 1 pound of salmon produced. And we talk about ecosystem-based management, and one of the things that is we think as a first step towards ecosystem-based management is looking at those forage species and setting the catch levels with their larger role in the ecosystem in mind, so that you figure out how much of that forage, either a sardine or a squid or something like that, needs to be left in the water as food for the rest of the ecosystem. And right now, that is not well done.
I'd like to speak to this one, too, if I could.
Sure.
Chuck brings up a very good issue, and the place he's from, Alaska, is really a bellwether for good fisheries management. You know, the largest single species fishery in the world is Alaska walleye pollock, and it's well-managed and stable in terms of catch. And so he's in a place in the world where good fisheries management is producing a surplus of fish. The economic issues that he brings up are very important. If you look at the total U.S. catch in the United States, it produces about $4 billion a year in value to fishermen. But on the debit side, we import about $11 billion of seafood, and much of it is in aquaculture production from Southeast Asia and from South America and other places. And so this competes directly with the wild-caught fish, in many cases at much lower prices. And we have this problem in salmon and also in shrimp. We have a tremendous import of aquaculture-based shrimp into the United States. And so in some case sense, we haven't been able to establish a ecologically sustainable aquaculture in the United States, or at least get a policy. And so we're exporting these ecological consequences around the globe. What we do need is a much more logical aquaculture policy in the United States that would allow us to produce more fish in a way that's much more sustainable in terms of the ecosystem. And I think this has been one of the priorities that we've had legislatively, to try to get authority to do aquaculture, particularly in offshore areas, in a sustainable way.
Can I also weigh in shortly on this?
Sure.
I think this is a really, really important point. Salmon in Alaska is one of the prime examples for good management, as Steve has said, where they preserve the biodiversity of the stock complex and they have a very resilient structure there. And I really applaud that. And I do see the problem there that consumers are not able right now to distinguish well between a sustainable product, which Alaska salmon is, and an unsustainable product, which a lot of the aquaculture salmon is. And I think we need, as consumers, we need to get much more savvy in distinguishing between seafoods that are sustainable, both aquacultured and wild seafoods, and those that are not, because on both sides you have some that are sustainable and some are not. The Marine Stewardship Council or the Monterey Bay Aquarium come up with these consumer guides that can guide our decision, make mm-hmm. us more conscious of what we buy and how it contributes either to overfishing or to the converse.
And also, it's also healthier, the wild fish. It's got fewer pesticides in them, things like that, that are in the foods that we feed them.
You know, it's quite interesting. We just released a large study on the health benefits and risks of seafood that was conducted by the National Institute of Medicine. And what they actually found was that in terms of the heart quality, actually cultured salmon is a little bit better for you than wild. And that seems somewhat ironic, but the fact of the matter is that cultured salmon is a little bit higher in omega-3 fatty acids. And so these are the compounds that are related to heart disease. And so there certainly are issues of contaminants versus the heart quality issues of seafood. But we can't necessarily look at all these issues as if they're negatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, my answer to that is you just take an omega-3 pill once a day. And you've made up that deficit, and you can go eat the fresh fish.
Well, that's a good point, but where do these pills come from? Omega-3
right.
fatty acids
right.
come from wild fish. So I totally agree with you. There's not just food issues here. There's health benefits and a whole range of ecosystem benefits that come from fish and other elements of the marine ecosystems. And we just can't afford, really, not just mm-hmm. economically, but for health benefits as well, to lose these very, very yeah. valuable resources.
Do we think that with the new Democratic Congress coming in, that it might be friendlier to domestically produced fish and perhaps putting tariffs on foreign imports, helping out fishermen?
In my view, it's a consumer responsibility. We shouldn't look mm-hmm. for politicians, because the information is freely available. You can make an informed choice of where your fish is coming from. You can ask where it's coming from. Some of the fish are certified by the Marine Stewardship Council, Alaska Salmon among them, MSC.org. You can go through the web and find out where you can get them, which restaurants or suppliers support that fishery. So there's an infrastructure in place, and we just mm-hmm. have to tap into it.
Let's go to Jose in Millsboro, Delaware. Hi, Jose.
How you doing?
Hi there.
I'm a guy basically on the front line of all this. I'm one of the bigger consumptionists down here. Actually, in-laws are afraid I'm going to eat all the blue crabs in Rehoboth Bay. And I also teach marine sciences and do an outreach. Did I lose you guys?
No, you're here. No. Go ahead.
Okay. I also teach an outreach program. And one thing that I got a question, and then I got a few comments. My one main question is, I have heard that we take more protein worldwide out of the oceans than all the plant and animal protein that we produce terrestrial combined. Could that be true?
I don't think that is true. I think seafood is contributing somewhere between 10 and 20% to world protein supply, so most of the protein we consume comes from the land. Still, the protein that comes from the... Yes.
Okay. Yes. So it is not true. But
I don't think that
animal,
is...
Could it be true? The animal protein?
That could potentially be true. I'm not
that
sure.
That one-third of it we grind up into fish meal, and we feed it to our cows, pigs, and chicken.
That is true, yes.
And then another thing that I want to applaud, I forget exactly which one of you gentlemen brought up the whole thing that we are moving out to waterfront everywhere, and the ruining, and most people don't even know what an estuary is most of the time when I talk to them about it. That's where 80% of everything we like to harvest, that's their nursery ground. That's where they come in to grow up, or they go even further up, like salmon or striper. And the other 20% eat that 80%. So indirectly, mm-hmm. I really question if we are messing with our estuaries, is that even worse than overfishing?
Lake Crockett, any reaction?
Well, that's exactly true. The estuaries are the nursery grounds of some 75% of the federally managed fish, and they are under tremendous pressure from development, wetlands loss, and dredging, and seagrass loss, and that sort of thing. So it's very important, and I think it adds to the difficulty in managing the ocean fish because of that pressure on the nursery habitats. I think we need to be much more cautious in how we manage our ocean fish. And Steve Murawski talked about Alaska. One of the things that they do in Alaska is they use precautionary management. So they put a buffer in to the catch levels. They don't catch right up to the exact amount that the models say they can catch. And the other thing that they do is they pay attention to what the scientists say up there. And they are bound by the scientific recommendations, and that isn't always the case in other parts of the country.
I was on the West Coast for a while teaching for the L.A. County in Los Angeles Harbor doing an on-the-water laboratory classroom where the kids would pull an otter trawl on board. And from what I noticed, when I was younger there and diving in L.A. Harbor and also studies that were done there, that the biomass and the biodiversity in L.A. Harbor that was completely changed from being a shallow estuary to a deep water harbor, matter of fact, I think the largest in the United States when it comes to what goes through there, you know, that the biomass and the biodiversity have gone up, especially from the 70s and the 60s.
All right, Jose, thank you for taking time to talk with us. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking about the fish populations this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Gentlemen, any final comments? Any final thoughts?
I would just like to comment on the nursery habitat decline
yes.
that was brought up.
Yes.
That was part of our study as well. We were not looking at just how fishery was declining, but at some of the other components of the ecosystem that are so essential. And in the historical data that came from 12 estuaries and coastal regions around the world, my co-author Heike Lotze, she showed that 33% of the fisheries declined, but 69% of the nursery habitat declined. So that was an even much larger and more drastic effect on nursery habitats that are so essential, as the gentleman just said. And finally, there was a 63% also in the decline in species that were filtering the water and detoxifying wastes, and that caused all sorts of problems with water quality in these estuaries. So the fishery may be the most obvious one, but some of the effects on nursery habitats and filter function may be even more drastic, and because they have human health implications, also very important to many people, not only those who eat seafood.
So these are basically considered two different areas, the fish out in the ocean and the fish and the seafood in the estuaries.
No, we just looked at them through different analysis, and this one particularly looked at 12 estuaries and coastal ecosystems, also like the North Sea, the Baltic Sea, the Adriatic, and Chesapeake Bay, San Francisco Bay, lots of estuaries in the U.S., and it showed these numbers that I just cited.
Mm-hmm. So the shellfish are in trouble.
Yes, shellfish closures went up by 235% over the time frame we looked at, and harmful toxic algae blooms went up 450%. So there's a lot of negative changes there, and people are seeing this, and people are concerned about it.
And there's no quick fix to this.
No quick fix, but as we said, I mean, the legislation is there. Also here in Canada, we have an Oceans Act that says all the right things. Mm-hmm. But the implementation is slow and cumbersome. And as somebody said, people just don't want to take their medicine. And the medicine is clear what it is, how to fix this. It's just hard to do on the ground politically. And I mean, I applaud Steve and others who are on the front lines and try to enforce this. It's not easy, and nobody mm-hmm. says it's easy, but it's got to be done.
Steve, how do you enforce it? I have about a minute. Give me a minute thumbnail of how to enforce this.
Well, certainly we have a number of acts that regulate all of this. We're trying to strengthen the Major Fishery Protection Act called the Magnuson Act by actually having laws that say we can end overfishing in a time certain way. We think that's important. We think we need some new legislation on aquaculture. And the point about wetlands is very, very critical. That is, you know, wetlands not only are the nursery areas for fish offshore, but they're also the first line of protection from coastal storms and other things, as we saw in Katrina. We need to pay attention to the coastal margins of the United States and to back people off from the building right on the margin of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Lee Crockett, Executive Director of Marine Fish Conservation Network in Washington. Boris Worm, Professor of Marine Conservation Biology at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Steve Murawski, Chief Scientist at NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service in Silver Spring. And Patrick Sullivan, Associate Professor in the Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University in Ithaca. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time to be with us today. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heist. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington, Charles Berquist in New York. Our intern is Steve Orns. Odette Youssef and Barry Hardiman worked on the phones for us today. If you'd like to write us, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave email for us there. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is up there, free teaching material. And we're blogging and podcasting. I could start something new, pogging with a anyhow. At our website, you can also get back editions of Science Friday there. And also, there's a social community in Facebook on Science Friday if you want to log in there and join our social community. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.